Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
To the Antique Podcast Show. I'm Martin Willis.
And I'm Phyllis Gall. And this is just one of many informative and entertaining shows we hope to bring to you about art and collecting and auctions and the whole business.
And hey, guess what? We're on iTunes now. So you can go to the iTunes store and search under Auction Podcasts or Antique Auction Podcasts. And please do rate us and do write a review.
Yes, preferably a very nice review.
A good review would be good. So thank you for all your emails. We really enjoy the support we're having from this.
And please send us more inquiries and, you know, lovely comments and fan mail. We love fan mail.
Yes, we get fan mail from all of our fan, singular. No, we have
out there, thank you.
Yes, and most of our fans are our relatives, right? But, you know, that's okay.
Well, who's counting?
Yeah, all right.
So the email address is auctionpodcast@me.com. That's auctionpodcast@me.com.
Okay, today we are doing a podcast on the Civil War and collecting Civil War memorabilia. We have a special phone guest coming up. And basically, this is a segment of collecting that I think is very fascinating because if you really think about it, a lot of people, the different ways people collect, they collect for beauty, say art for beauty, they collect antiques for the quality of furniture.
They speculate, they try to,
which is kind of a difficult thing to do these days to figure out what's going to go up or down. I always tell people to collect what they like. And as far as collecting Civil War memorabilia, what you're actually collecting is more history than anything else. Because that's what everything's based on. And the Civil War, you know, just touch, could only scratch the surface of the Civil War. There was a lot of reasons why it happened. There was problems with the North and the South going all the way back to the Revolutionary War, just after that, I should say. And there was a lot of issues. It wasn't just slavery like everyone thinks. There were a lot of issues. And I believe it was South Carolina or North Carolina was the first one to secede from the Union, and then other states followed. There was a lot of issues that caused the actual outbreak. And later, when we're talking to John, he can get a little more into that. There's a lot of reasons why people collect the Civil War, and some of them are personal. You know, there were a lot of people collect because a relative of theirs was involved in the Civil War. And if you were here in this country for long enough, you were touched by the Civil War in one way or another, and in many ways. And I remember my grandfather saying his great grandfather was in the Civil War in Georgia, so he's a Confederate soldier.
Wow!
If you really think about it, you know, it was the North against South. It was brother against brother. I think there was some type of situation that was called out—a brother against brother, some battle or something like that. Maybe John knows what that is. But so there was. If you can imagine. I mean, just try to imagine today what it would be like if we had a Civil War today. We'd probably just nuke each other or something like that. But, you know, no, really, I mean, can you imagine, like, states divided in one country, how difficult that would be if you can really put yourself in that? The only difference is we have different transportation today and different communication. But it wasn't other than that, you know, I mean, people were pitted against each other in the same, you know, confines of a country.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, war is really, I mean, besides it being detrimental to, you know, to contemporary life, it creates a lot of repercussions for artifacts later and for collecting later. I mean, a lot of people collect around war.
Yeah, that's true.
World War II.
World War One, World War Two, Spanish-American War.
It just...
Yeah. So there are collectors for everything. The Civil War, I think, is fascinating. Excuse me. You know, it was a four-year war. They thought it would be over in just a few weeks. And it was a war that just kept dragging on. The South was a lot tougher than they thought. Jefferson Davis, I believe, was appointed as president. You know, years ago when I did the Josiah Bartlett auction, in that lot, even though it was all the way back from the sign of the Declaration, the family had a Jefferson Davis calling card and mixed in with everything. It was very, very interesting to see that. It was actually pretty valuable.
Sold for some
pretty good money.
Yeah.
But anyway, we have a special phone guest, John Ackerbloom, all the way from the state of Maine. Hello, John.
Hello, Marty. How are you doing today?
We're doing good here.
Very good. Good,
hi,
to, good to be here, and thank you for asking me to participate in this. It sounds very interesting, and you've certainly hit on a lot of the facts so far. Yeah, that's great.
Well, thank you. Hey, John, I have always respected your opinion. You've had some a great foresight, and John and I go way back for many years. He's a guy who actually helped me out in the auction business with many times with items that I had that would come up at auction. And John would actually do the research, never ask for a penny either.
Wow.
And after you tell me what the things were, you bid on it. Now, that that's kind of unprecedented for most collectors and dealers. I always appreciated that, John.
Well, I, it's like you say, I enjoyed the history. Thank you very much for saying that. I always put history first, value last, and yeah, there are a lot of things that I'd like to own out there, but I always felt it was important to pass along some of the information. I may not necessarily do that today as I did 20 years ago, but I still enjoy the history.
So, John, what started your interest in Civil War collecting, and do you remember what the first item was that you ever bought?
Sure. Well, actually, in your introduction there, you say I'm calling from the state of Maine, which is my home state now. I've been here, 25 years or more now. But I originally grew up outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And the Philadelphia area was rich with history and school trips and such. We always used to, when I was in my early teens, you know, Washington, D.C. was a short hour and a half, 2 hours away, and the Loyal Legion Museum in Philadelphia, the Pine Street Museum, which is now they've renamed the Underground Railroad Museum, and it's in storage, but they're trying to get it out now. So really, I trace my interest back to my, like you say, interest in history growing up as a student, cleaning out my grandmother's house, which at the time was in Springfield, Massachusetts. I have relatives who worked at Springfield Armory. Finding a Civil War belt, finding an identified Civil War knife, to school in Philadelphia, and then we had a teacher who used to do these mini segments on history, and she brought in her grandfather's uniform one time, and, and that's what really where my interest began was right there.
Now, did you say that you found in your? I'm sorry, did you say it was your grandmother's estate, her house?
My grandmother was president of the Massachusetts Button Society. She had a huge button collection, which we still mostly have to this day. She passed away in the 80s. Excuse me, back in the 70s. So, you know, a fair number of years ago. But in the estate, I had some relatives' items, but it was just paper goods. But the people who lived around my grandmother used to give her things, and so I got a U.S. buckle on the belt with the soldier's initials scratched in the back, and I got an identified pocket knife that was a presentation piece probably by the family, dated 1863, soldier's full name and regiment on the knife, which is, you know, even unusual in this day. My first item purchased was, when I'm like 12 years old, almost 50 now. When I was 12 years old, I figured out you could buy this stuff, you know, and it wasn't as expensive as it is today. So my first piece was an early muskets that I still have to this day.
Oh, wow.
All right, wow.
1861, yeah.
Now, way back before internet and all that, I know a lot's changed since then, but As a person that age, how did you find your first Civil War item?
Well, the musket that I purchased, I actually hitting antique shops.
I see.
Always as a kid, you know, I had the interest in history, but I always had an interest in antiques in general. So we have a summer home in the Adirondacks, and I used to go up there in the summer when I could get my dad to take me out. And I found a guy in an antique shop, had a musket on the wall, didn't seem high priced, and I thought it was kind of neat, so I bought it.
Wow. Did you save up allowance to buy it?
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah. I was working as in the early teenage years. I began working on cutting grass as a kid. Was always a big thing to raise money.
Oh yeah, I did plenty of that.
Yeah.
Now, did you actually find out more information on the musket?
Well, muskets are tough. Muskets during the Civil War were made in vast quantities, and Springfield Armory literally made hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. The 1861 was put out to contract to, I think, 26 manufacturers. This was one of the private manufacturers who manufactured the model along the lines of the Springfield musket. This was a Parker Snow. So you can trace it to the year of manufacture. You can trace it to the model, but unless it has something inscribed on the stock or such, they're pretty generic and hard to track down as to who actually used them.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
There are special markings on certain guns to this day, and the early muskets did not have a serial number. Now, you start to get into the carbines of the Civil War, they start to have serial numbers, and they have been able to successfully track down what regiments were issued certain guns and certain serial number ranges. So if you start to get into an identified gun with a serial number, then you can start to track who actually used them.
And the area of weapons in the Civil War, is there a type of weapon that is more desirable than another? I mean, you say muskets were mass-produced.
Desirable in collectability, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's hard to say. Excuse me. Everybody has a different interest, you know. Some like pistols, some like long guns, some like cannons, some like swords. Wow. So the value really goes with the rarity of the item, but everybody has different interests, and if you look across the spectrum of the collector's world, everybody's involved in every asset, and some people are universal collectors across all spectrums, some just specialize in one area.
Now, how much, like to say, if you had, let's just say, you had a sword, okay, you had a Civil War sword, and the sword was worth one price. But now you have a Civil War sword, and you have a picture of the, say, the officer wearing the sword, and you have his diary. Does that, like, really increase the value?
Excuse me. Yes, it does. You have to verify the fact that the items came together unless the sword is marked.
I see.
Yeah, okay. Obviously, one area is fakery and trickery. And it's very easy to take a picture and stick it with a sword and say they came together, but in this day and era, to add that extra value on and premium on price, you have to verify that those items actually came out together. And you either do that by buying them at a family estate sale or an auction where you can actually show that they exited the house together, or you have a notarized letter from a relative who's selling them out of the house, or the fact that the sword then has made, you know, it was very common to engrave the scabbards and the hilts with the soldier's name if they were above a certain rank. If you're just Buck Private Joe on the back of a horse with a sword, chances are you didn't put your name on your sword.
I see.
But the difference in premium is probably 10 to 20 fold. It depends upon the exact item, you know. But yes, value does go up when it's identified.
I feel like there's so many things I want to ask, but one of the things you just touched on was whether it was just a private. For I remember we had a conversation many, many years ago, and you told me that officers were wealthy. They put their uniforms in the closet. The privates were poor, and they wore them in the fields. That was the only clothes they had. So it was very rare to find a private's uniform intact. Is that true? Do I remember that right?
Martin, you have a fantastic memory. That's dead on correct. Yeah, I learned at an early age that a private's pair of pants and a private's fatigue coat, which is the pants or trousers, and the coat is considered a four-button fatigue sack jacket from the Civil War, are extremely rare, because when the average private soldier went home after the war, if he went out to plow the corn or work in the woods or whatever, he wore his pants out in the woods. He didn't necessarily stick them away. And so it was a functionality factor in terms of the lower-level soldiers, where as an officer's clothing, he had to buy his clothing. The enlisted soldier bought them, but they were mere dollars compared to what an officer paid for a fine dress pants and coat. And they tended to come from richer, more educated families. and they might have a nice presentation sword, and they'd get home from the war, and they'd say, you know what, I'm going to put these in a trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't see an officer out plowing corn wearing his dress frock coat, you know.
Right.
But you might see a private guy out there in his fatigue coat because it just looked like another wool shirt.
Hmm.
Right.
So that's what happened. Yeah, the private's equipment stayed relatively scarce and rare because it was worn out, whereas the officer's clothing seems to be, I'm not going to say more common. Common's not a good word, but more prevalent.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you know offhand roughly how many people were estimated to fight in the Civil War? How many soldiers?
How many people fought?
Mm-hmm.
I think, off the top of my head, I don't know, but for some reason, 2.5 to 3 million strikes a chord.
I know it was something like 620,000 people died.
Yeah.
Something like that, which is really amazing if you think about one nation against itself, and it's just
The bloodshed
amazing.
Yeah, 600. I have the calculator sitting here. 620,000. I think casualties by death were 15 to 20%. So 620,000 with a 20% casualty rate would be 3.1 million. So I think the soldier numbers were about 3 million.
Okay.
Wow, you're good at math too. That's.
I have the calculator sitting here.
Oh, we're gonna be really impressed, John.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have said that.
I know, you should have left that part out.
I should have let you.
Yeah.
So, John, I took a peek at your website, and I saw that you focus on the 25th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry.
Yep.
So, why do you focus on that?
Well, the website is really something that I keep casually. I have a little antique business that I do on the side, so there are a few things posted on there. But I really started up the website so that I could put some history on it and share some of the knowledge that I was finding out about the market.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look back at my Civil War collecting history, I always said I collected the Northern Infantry and Cavalry Soldier. Over times, earlier in my collecting history, I used to be very broad. I used to do artillery. I used to do Navy. I used to do either side of the Civil War. I had guns from the Revolution all the way up to World War II. But just over time, it's such a wide area, I couldn't do that. So I chose to focus down. So as I focused down, I came down to the Northern Infantry and Cavalry Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But then the 25th Massachusetts was an area where you stumble across items over time, and you find things over time, and then you realize when you look back at your collection, well, hey, I have three things from this regiment, four things from this regiment, and the 25th Massachusetts was a regiment that was raised in Worcester, Mass., just north of Springfield, Massachusetts.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Very rich community, well-educated community. At that time, schooling was mandated for them, and I literally fell into a series of like six or eight items in a month, and I bought something, got it. I came along, another 25th item, got it. I bought three diaries for a soldier, got it. Then I bought like 25 photographs of different soldiers and got it.
Mm.
And then after a month and a half, I said, you know what, I think I'm collecting 25th Mass. And just over time, I've tried to I won't say I focus on it, but I will go out of my way to get something for that regiment.
Because
now I know all the players, you know, mostly. A regiment was considered about 1,000 individuals when they first formed.
Uh-huh.
Over attrition and during the war, that would weed down to 200 to 300 through battle. But their claim to fame, 25th Massachusetts claim to fame, it was a three-year regiment that reenlisted. They formed in October of 1861, like I said, in Worcester, Massachusetts. But they did General Grant's campaign against Petersburg and Richmond against Lee in 64. And in a six-week time period, they were in battle nearly every day.
Wow.
And just as everybody knows Gettysburg, everybody, I hope, knows Pickett's Charge, where he, you know, charged the Union lines with the Confederate soldiers, and they got hammered pretty hard. Grant's, quote, Pickett's Charge was called Cold Harbor in Virginia, in which he ordered a charge on Lee's army. And the charge lasted less than 10 minutes, and I think it was 7,500 soldiers were killed in that 10 minutes.
Wow.
You're kidding. Wow.
The 25th Massachusetts was one of the regiments that led that charge. And in that particular battle, they suffered 75% casualties.
Wow, that's something.
They lost 110 soldiers in 10 minutes killed.
Oh, my God. And you said, what year was that?
That was, that particular battle was June 3rd, 1864.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was walking in the, back in the woods back in Northampton, New Hampshire, and you know how the that whole area was all cleared at one time, and now the trees are all grown up, and now it's woods where it used to be pasture land. I came up into a over a hill, top of a hill, and I saw a cemetery, and I started reading the stones, and there were three sons that were all in the all killed in the Civil War, and one family. Can you imagine that?
Mm.
Now I remember Lincoln. Didn't he write a? Isn't there a famous letter that he wrote, or Mary Lincoln wrote? I'm not really sure. In regards to there was a major casualties in one family in the North States.
Yeah, actually, if you see Tom Hanks' movie Saving Private Ryan, it's a movie about a soldier during World War II who all his other brothers were killed, and it was just left himself out in the field, and he was the last soldier, the last son of a lady. And in the opening 15 minutes of the movie Saving Private Ryan, the officer who sends the troops to go rescue Private Ryan quotes the Lincoln letter.
Oh,
oh wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know it verbatim, but it's a, yeah. That's during the Civil War, there was no law against joining a single regiment with your brothers or your father or your cousins.
Mm.
And oftentimes what happened, if you joined with your brothers and your dad, you would all go into the same battle together. And fighting together, oftentimes you died together. And literally single battles would wipe out whole families.
Mm.
So there was legislation passed, and I think it was World War One. I may be incorrect here, but it did definitely was in place during World War Two, where relatives could not join the same unit.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Wow.
And
that's
in
totally
Saving Private
sense.
Ryan, the brothers that were actually killed, one was in the Pacific, one was in France, one was in Germany. You know, they were scattered around. They weren't in the same unit. They just so happened to pass away in different locations.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that the 25th Mass, they were in that terrible battle in 64, June 3rd, 64. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the war, how many were left from the 25th Mass? Do you know?
Well, when you talk about casualties during the Civil War, there's those that were actually killed in action, KIA, and there were those who were wounded, and there was those who were wounded who came back, and those who were wounded and did not come back. So
right.
When people talk of casualties during the Civil War, they tend to talk in gross numbers for those that were both wounded and killed in action.
I see.
But then, of course, the greatest killer was disease. So if we talk raw numbers, the original regiment, when it formed, was 1,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
I think direct killed in action were somewhere around 165. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Wounded in action, you know, you're probably talking the same number, maybe more. And then died of disease was somewhere in the area of 80 to 120.
Okay.
So at the end of the war, when the regiment actually mustered out, which is your ending phase, there were only three companies out of an 11-company regiment.
Mm.
And it was, I think the final numbers at the end of the war were less than 200 that were actively marching with the unit.
Wow.
So John, just to steer the program toward more of what I think some of our listeners may be listening
sorry,
to us.
I get really into the history.
No, I love the history part of it. And again, that's why people collect. But if we can talk more about the items and collecting and things like that. First of all, you know, I want to talk a little bit of how a novice would collect today. But before I talk about that, I want to talk a little prelude to that is about fakes. I do also remember stopping into your place back in Kittery, Maine, and you showing me a hat that just looked, I mean, I've looked at a lot of textiles over the years, and you told me this was a fake. And I couldn't believe the fabric. I believe it was period fabric, the threads, the stitching. They had to use everything to make this fake. So let's talk about how careful does a novice collector have to be as far as fakes go?
I think he has to be extremely careful. Anything that's worth any value in the market today, obviously there's going to be an evil lurking evil individual out there is willing to fake it, try to pass it off as an original. So any genre of collecting in the Civil War, be it photographs, swords, high-grade pistols, uniforms especially, knives, Bowie knives, there are people trying to fake them. And there's a difference between faking it and a reproduction. Obviously, sure. There are guns that are reproduced today that look just like the original pieces, and people will take those reproductions sometimes and grind off the word reproduction or age them in the ground to look old and then try and pass them off an original. That's just evil.
Yeah.
On uniform pieces and the hat that you mentioned, people will try and age something. We also commonly see stuff from Europe. There was a lot of the American uniforms during the Civil War were a copy of French designs. So there are a lot of late 1880s, 1890s French and Belgian uniforms that appear very similar to what we use during the Civil War, but aren't. And there are people who go to Europe, find these items cheaper, bring them over here, artificially age them, and then mix them into the market, trying to say pass them off as Confederate so that they'd be worth more money, or pass them off as ID so they'd be worth more money. So it is. The hardest part is figuring it out. So you first have to realize what you're going to collect. And I always tell people, you know, one of the first factors that was given to me was, you know, buy a library. Get a good library, get the books, but you can't beat handling the items. So in order to handle the items, you really need to network with some of the key collectors out there. Attend the auctions, look at the items.
Yep.
Handle them, go to the museums. The museums won't let you handle them, but you can certainly look them over.
Right.
And one of my principal things I did, I was very lucky, knock on wood, that I fell in with some key collectors in the Philadelphia area. Don Troiani, a nationally recognized artist, is also probably has the largest holdings in the United States now for American military items. Revolutionary, pre-revolution, all the way through World War II. Don's a good friend. I knew him when he was art school in Philadelphia. And just, you know, you can't beat 35 years of networking with these people. But if you're starting fresh, go to gun shows. Try and meet collectors. Don't stay in a closet collecting mode. Don't think, oh, I have all this great stuff and I'm just, nobody knows I have it. Because chances are, if nobody knows you have it, you don't have what you think you have.
You know, I've seen countless... I don't want to say countless, but I've seen so many of the fake Tiffany Civil War buckles and the Wells Fargo, you know, that they're just, I think the buckles, they have to be like one of the number one fakes, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. part of that is the Tiffany buckles are oftentimes reproductions of buckles that didn't even exist.
And right.
People age that and they see the Tiffany word. You know, greed or not necessarily greed, but... If you're a starting collector and you think, oh, my gosh, here's something great, you know, 9 times out of 10, it is too good to be true.
Right. Exactly.
I always say that. And 9 times out of 10, when I'm called on the phone to come look at a uniform, it's not what it is. And not always does the family know what they actually have. It may have been handed down through the family as Uncle Ed's Civil War trousers that he wore during the Civil War. But I tell you, 9 times out of 10, 99 out of 100 times even sometimes, it's not. It's a pair of pants that were his GAR post-war pants or his World War I pants. And
Grand Army of the Republic.
The family doesn't necessarily, so don't listen to the family either.
Are there people that, it's Grand Army of the Republic, right?
Yeah, GAR, and, Grand Army of the Republic. Yeah.
Now, some people collect that. I mean, aren't there collectors of that too?
There are. Sons of Union veterans, GAR. Obviously, you know, a four buttons fatigue sack coat, 20,000 to 30,000, I think. One out of the John Henry Kurtz collection sold at auction last year for right around $50,000. That's your standard private's fatigue coat. But GAR coats, which are five-button with different buttons and were not manufactured specifically during the war, you can find for $300-$400.
A little bit of a difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
So people say, well, if I can't afford this, then I'll focus my collecting in this area. And the focusing the collecting is on the veteran stuff. And obviously, there are people who like the veteran stuff.
Now, going back to Tiffany, Charles Tiffany, I know, made a fortune selling his wares to Civil War, you know, buttons and buckles and things like that. Did he ever, see, I just don't know enough about that. Was there ever a way a way to distinguish a Tiffany, like buttons or buckles or anything like that?
Most of the buttons during the Civil War were marked on the back. Mm-hmm. So if he was a marketer of a button that was manufactured by somebody else, he would put his name on it. But we don't see it necessarily a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we saw it on high-end swords, and that way he would acid etch engrave his name into the blade or something, and mm-hmm. so it would be marked in that fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you mentioned a few minutes ago about books and getting a library, and I think this is a really good point mm-hmm. because everyone just thinks today, oh, I'll go to the internet. But I know that when it comes to Civil War, along with a lot of other things, but not all the information is available on the internet. I mean, you have to dig in books a lot of times, don't you?
Yeah, I don't know how big my library numbers in terms of number of book, but easily a couple thousand volumes in my research library. Mm-hmm. Early on, you know, I had to buy all the regimentals, the research, the soldiers. I have a full set of official records of the Civil War, 130 volume
wow.
set, which is now on CD. You can get a lot of research on the internet for soldiers' names now, and certainly the internet has sped up the process in terms of researching and finding soldiers' name if it's associated with an item. But in terms of collecting uniforms and stuff, the best books that are published are the ones that are researched and brought forward by the people who study the Civil War. And that's another important fact. When you're networking with the people who collect, the hardcore collectors, are also networking with those who study it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'll find the crossover, like the Don Trionis, the Fred Gatys, the Paul Lones of this world, who are key Civil War collectors, are also key researchers and are also mm-hmm. key publishers. And, you know, they want to get an article out there on something. They may sit on a key piece of information for a couple of years if it's rare and unique and is associated with something, but they don't mind sharing something from their collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought I was really lucky. Did you happen to know Joe Copley years ago in Portsmouth?
Yes, yep. Huge badge collector, of course you know that. You've sold some of his badges. Yeah,
yeah. He was a wealth of knowledge. And when you talk about Don Trione and people like that, you know, it's if they don't put things down in books and they don't have someone you know mentoring under them, it's a shame to see all that knowledge and all the connections that they had, you know, just kind of fade away when we lose these people. You know,
Don is an artist, and he actually ties the history of the items into his artwork. But he does have four or five books that he has published now, and he does write articles. If you call him up on the phone, Joe Smith, out of the blue, and ask for a piece of information, he may not be so free to share it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Joe Copley, old Portsmouth badge collector, I think Joe at one time, you know, Marty, what do you have, 6,000 badges in
collection? Oh, it was amazing.
Wow.
He had some of the rarest, too, you know, the very rarest, I think. A lot of them, when he passed away, I think a lot of them were donated very quietly, never really heard where they went to.
Hmm.
Yeah, a lot of them did disappear. But he did fire badges, he did Civil War badges, he did all kinds of badges, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he had, I think he had some, all the way back to George Washington, he had some, I'm trying to remember, is it Medal of Honor or one of the badges that cannot be sold legally, basically?
That's Medal of Honor from the Civil War, presented by Congress to a soldier for a deed of valor. I had one at the house. Actually, you're right. The government has stepped in a few years ago and forbade the use of selling them because some people were wearing them, more modern badges, Medal of Honor, as their own, but it was not.
Mm.
I was thinking.
I remember having one, and I remember when Joe was alive, and I actually showed it to him. He's like, oh, yeah, I have like 60.
Yeah, that's something. I thought the government stepped in. I mean, they're very valuable. I know he told me one of the, you know, just one was worth like $20,000 or something like that years ago. I think that's what he told me.
Hmm.
But I think the issue with selling them, is that the government wouldn't want someone to profit on something that they consider their own.
Right, because it was presented by Congress, the government felt it should be able to control, and they did mandate that they can be traded from family member to family member, but they don't want them traded on the open market.
Mm.
But the whole furor over it began by people who falsely claimed to have won it and didn't.
Mm.
And that's, you know, those were World War II and Vietnam medals of valor.
Speaking of evil.
Medals of honor.
And, yeah, that's...
But the reason Joe and I and you saw so many is... During the Civil War, the 27th Maine was based in Kittery, Maine, mm-hmm. and 435-some-odd soldiers stayed in D.C. to protect President Lincoln when Lee was invading Gettysburg, and they were all issued the Medal of Honor.
Hmm.
So there was a high frequency of finding these medals here in Kittery because a large grouping of soldiers actually here were issued them. Kittery at one time had the highest number of Medal of Honor winners. I think it was something like 27 from a single town because of that issuance. Congress issued it, and then several years later, they declared that it wasn't a valor deed, and they rescinded the medal to these soldiers and asked for it back. The commanding officer who lives right up around the corner from my house during the Civil War basically told the government to get lost and buried them in his backyard.
Oh, my God.
I think the reason Joe had 60 is because he secretly discovered that stash at one time.
Wow. Oh, my God. Right? What a story.
Yeah.
Joe was...
That's what he claimed. He wouldn't come out and say it. But you remember, Joe. He'd look at you wink and the smile would come across his face. And...
Yeah.
Wow.
He used to say, Joe knows.
Yeah,
and boy,
exactly.
I'll tell you. He was a walking library.
I haven't thought of him in a while.
Yeah, he was a great guy. Let's talk a little bit about what do you think has happened? I did a segment a while back on the internet and how it's changed, you know, collecting and all that. What do you think about the internet? What's it changed in doing?
Well, it has caused it to be more global. Mm-hmm. There are people around the world who have a greater access to it. It also leads to greater fakery.
Sure, that's what I was
thinking. I used to say to people that I wouldn't buy something extremely rare unless I could have it in my hands to guarantee the fact that it was right. But with the exchange rates on the international market now and the economy depressed here and the euro so strong, Europeans today can actually pay more than Americans can because of the shift in the exchange rate. And there are a portion of people over there who collect American Civil War, or even, you know, World War One and World War Two. There's a huge grouping of World War One and World War Two items that are going back to Europe now, just because of the exchange rate shift.
Wow.
For World War One and World War Two, I would, you know, that makes sense because they were world wars. But have you seen any foreign Civil War collectors?
I do. I know a couple. My greatest story is I also collected 10th Massachusetts at one time, and I was looking for a particular photograph of a soldier, and I posted it on the internet. And a guy from Australia actually had the image.
And he was Australian. He wasn't an expat or anything.
No, he wasn't an expat. There was, lo and behold, a bunch of 10th Massachusetts Civil War soldiers, when the war was over, went to Australia, and they brought stuff with them.
Oh, nuts.
There was this grouping of Civil War stuff in Australia, and this guy responded to my ad, and then I didn't hear from him for a little while, and like 3 weeks later in the mail, the photograph shows up.
Oh, wow.
And I called him up, and he said, you know, it should be in your collection, not mine.
Oh.
And I thought you should have it, and he sent it to me. That was a great gesture.
Holy mackerel.
Jeez.
Hey, speaking, while you're talking about a photograph, just quickly, earlier on you mentioned, when we were talking about fakes, you mentioned photographs. Now, are you saying that there's fake Civil War photographs?
Fake is a strong word.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just ask you this. Are you saying
I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to think how to word it here. There are photographers who travel around to reenacting events, soldiers who reenact these different battles. And yes, some of these reenactors collect. Some don't. Some do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just get into the reenacting and don't want anything to do with collecting the original item, but and that's one area you have to watch out for, because as reenactors use item and as they try and closely copy what was actually used years later, what they were actually made new 20 years ago now looks old and used, and someone is trying to deceive somebody and resell it on the market. So those things do pop up, but there are photographers who travel around with the original old cameras, take tintypes today of soldiers.
And
if you're a good reenactor, you're graded by how good you look and how good your equipment is. Some guys sew all their own uniforms, you know?
Really?
Jeez.
And so these guys will go around, take pictures of these people, and then every once in a while you'll see one of these pictures for sale and you'll go, you know what? I know that guy.
Or,
you know, that,
or it's you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I can remember at a gun show like 15 years ago, there was a rare uniform for sale, and they called some special people over to look at it. One of them was a friend of mine who was a reenactor, and he says, yeah, I know this uniform. That guy goes, really? I just paid X thousands of dollars for it. He says, that's kind of neat. I made that in 1962 for reenactment.
Oh, no.
You can see the color drain out of his face. But,
yeah,
well, you know, Marty, photography, there's rice paper, large albumin prints, there's daguerreotypes, there's tintypes, there's the CDVs, which are the Cartier-Bresse visiting cards.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that you really have to watch out for, because it's a black and white image.
Right.
A Cartier-Bresse, when it was a photograph, you would buy for a dollar 12 images. They may all be the same image. So you actually do see duplicates of those images in the market, and I own several duplicates of various things because they were produced in quantities of 10 or 12 or 15, and then you would give one to your niece, nephew, you know, grand, everybody, sweetheart.
Kind of like a school photo.
And since they are black and white, those on the Internet, you have to be a little cautious on those.
On the Internet. But if you handle them, of course, right away you'd see that they're not old.
Well,
right?
To the trained eye, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes people ask me, I'll say, well, that's no good, and I'll just hand it back to them. And they'll say, well, how do you know that?
So,
well, a 35 years experience, it's hard to for me to point, but you can point out. The first thing I tell people who are new collectors is first determine why it's right.
Mm-hmm.
Look at it and try and convince yourself what's wrong about it first. And if there's any hesitation, then don't pull the trigger.
That's right.
Don't purchase it.
You use that in many parts of what we do. You know, I mean, it's like a lot of times you have to figure guilty till proven innocent when it comes to these type of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I still use the Internet. I enjoy it, but for really rare and special and high-end items, I may track stuff that's going up at auction or stuff, but I really want to see it in my hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, when someone like you that has, you know, so much knowledge when it comes to these things, and you see a blatant fake, and just say, I'm just going to push a scenario. You're on eBay, okay? And all of a sudden you see this thing, you know for sure it's a fake. Do you feel like it's... do you feel a responsibility to say something, or just move on? I mean, if someone has a lot of
feedback. I do, and eBay takes a lot of heat for this, and there's a lot of various things. You know, they used to have the negative feedback, and they kind of did away with it, which was a sad thing.
Mm.
But they're riding a hard horse there, because they eBay goes in so many different directions, and people can be evil and say something's bad just to say it's bad, and it may not be, and how do they vet that out? It's a very hard process for them to organize. So eBay takes a lot of heat for that. But I do feel there is an obligation. And years ago when eBay started and you could do those things, there were a number of us calling these people out and saying various things. But then it would get into a prove-it scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who was doing this on purpose, you know, would say prove it, or you have no basis to say that, and then there was a lot of name calling.
Mm.
eBay and the Internet gives access to a lot of individuals, and a lot of individuals who might be small collectors out in the Midwest or West Coast don't necessarily know John Åkerblom in Maine, or, you know.
Well, you know, I have this fakes and frauds are a pet peeve with me. You know, you can't stop them. I mean, they're just, it's always been. I mean, you think of the Chinese were faking porcelains, you know, 400 years ago that were antique. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's just always going to be that the fakes are there. It's, however, the sad part of it is, and I think this is in all aspects of collecting, it hurts the value of the real item, whether you want to believe it or not. When there's enough of it, you think of Gallet glass or something like that. And when there's enough fakes and enough being sold and enough records of things being sold for low money, then it affects everybody. It's but there's nothing that can be done about it. You just have to, as a novice collector, you just have to be very, very careful. And I personally think I met this really nice gentleman here in the West Coast, and he's a collector of Babe Ruth and really serious baseball items. And when he accidentally buys a fake, say on eBay or whatever like that, the only thing he does is destroy it. And I think that's actually very honorable. Kind of wish that would happen to all the fakes, and make it more of a pure market. But, we can only do what we can do as individuals.
That's right. That is good. Make it disappear. I usually bury it in my collection someplace, but I don't necessarily destroy it. Maybe I should before those things come back out. We all get stuck.
Yes.
All get stuck. And that's my one story. As a small collector, I got burned early on. But someone sold me a Civil War uniform that wasn't a Civil War uniform.
Hmm. Oh.
I was like 14 at the time.
Aww.
And I networked with an expert who verified it wasn't. I had a guarantee that the uniform was or I would get my money back. At the time, it wasn't a lot of money in comparison today, $350. But for a 14-year-old, $350 was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he wouldn't give me my money back, and he fought me. And I actually, my father, God bless him, for to prove a point, we took the gentleman to small claims court. So,
good for him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't get anywhere.
Oh. I thought it was going to have a great...
The gentleman lost. He had to post a bond. I got half his loss, and he disappeared.
Mm.
I still had the uniform, and I got half the bond for what it was worth, but
yeah,
the man took off after that.
Wow.
Well, lesson learned.
But it was a good experience.
Yeah.
You do need to network. If you don't know, ask somebody who does.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the only advice I can offer.
I think that's great advice.
I had I was curious about something when we were talking about reenactments earlier. So in the reenactment, do the people reenacting actually use period pieces?
Some do.
Some do. Wow.
Some do. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that takes care of that. But now I have another question.
Okay.
What was my question?
Can I just jump in
ahead.
And ask a question? So, have you ever gone to any of those reenactments?
Sure. Yep.
Do you participate?
I don't. I have a outfit that I bought when I was younger. I had visions of doing that, but you can only do so much. I always say to my wife, I have too many hobbies.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. But I remember my question now. So you were saying you found that photo of the member of the 10th Mass in Australia. So you were looking specifically for a photo of a specific soldier.
That's correct.
So do people know what's out there, or do they just, they want to complete, a collection for a specific soldier, and they just see if there's a photograph available, or?
Well, there's two directions there. One, if you know somebody existed, be it a relative or you might own something for somebody,
mm-hmm.
and you want to improve the history of the item, not necessarily the value, but it will help the value, you can go out and cast out in
mm-hmm.
a general method looking for a photograph and crossing your fingers and hope the photograph exists.
Mm-hmm.
In that particular instance for that item, I owned all the insignia off of this gentleman's three uniforms and two of his hats.
Okay.
And I had the regimental history for the unit that was printed just after the Civil War. In the regimental history, they actually showed a Cardiovisa picture that was printed in the book of him wearing the insignia.
Oh, wow.
And like I just said earlier, Cardiovisa pictures were generally generated in groups of 10. So I knew in the greater world out there, there might be a high likelihood that one of those images survived.
Mm.
And being a paper image and mass produced. So when I cast out there, I thought it might exist.
Mm.
And it did.
And it did, and you got it.
Yep.
Nice.
Small world.
Yeah.
Now, John, I remember you, I was working on one time on trying to get a presentation cane that Abraham Lincoln presented to his family doctor out of a house. We talked about that, and you, at the time, you told me there's, I believe you said there's like four or five people in the country that will bid on at this level on this type of item. Is that still the case?
It tends to be. There was a large Lincoln collection came to auction through a firm down south last year that, from an individual who just collected Lincoln. But usually when you start to get into high end and Lincoln items can be extremely valuable. Other Civil War items that are extremely valuable are flags, Union flags, depending upon the unit, 50, 65,000. Confederate flags, 80, 100, 120,000. Cannons, 50, 80, $120,000 dollars a piece. High presentation swords can get up to $50,000, $80,000, some higher depending upon who they're presented to. So when you start talking in values in those high ranges, the highest ranges we're seeing in Civil War right now are for high-end presentation Colts. The Doc Murphy collection that's being sold over time. It's actually, there's another grouping of it coming up now. I mean, we're seeing $500,000 up to $1 million for some of those cased sets.
You
know, is that something Jim Julius handling?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Doc Murphy's out of Philadelphia, focused in on collecting Colts early on. I'm not quite sure. I haven't asked him personally why he's liquidating it right now. I know he is refocusing on other areas of the military that he's collecting, like Marshall pistols, early Flint rifles. You know, he's still active in the area. I think he has a Confederate belt collection that he does. But his Colts were his gems. I mean, he, a world-class collection, the only one like it. And he began liquidating it last year. And I don't want to speak for him whether it's the economy or change of direction in his collecting tone. I don't know.
Well, what I'm seeing in general in the with the way things are presently is that there's a sort of a shift away from the mediocre, and people are spending, even though the economy is tough, the really fine items, the top end items. There's more people for those today than there used to be, it seems, and people are there's less collecting of the mediocre and lower range items, which
that goes back to your original question. I think there's a smaller group of people going after the higher end items, and that's a function of available money in today's economy. Those who have money, I think, will always have money. If something rare comes up, they'll go after it. But there tends to be, you know, when you talk a Lincoln presentation sword or a Sam Colt presentation pistol to an officer or Secretary of State or something, there is but a handful of people who probably go after that. That's a function, a long-term function of what they have for available resources and what level of collecting that they're in. But I would agree, in general, the Civil War has suffered just like antiques and other areas. We've seen the mediocre and the average musket, the average sword has probably come off 40-50% in value in the last 2 years. I think it's more of, I think, a function there that the blue-collar collector who would tend to soak up those lower-level items doesn't need them so much now or may need the money more. So we see the items that are more common coming back onto the market more readily. And it's just a question of, I say, supply and demand, and the supply right now is exceeding the demand and is driving the value down, like trading commodities.
Do you think that the future, will always remain strong for Civil War?
In certain areas, like you say, in the rare areas, yes, and in the high end areas, yes, we do see that, but the middle ground and the lower ground. It's becoming hard. It's boiling down to supply and demand. It's always an argument in our hobby. Where are the new collectors? The age skewing of the collectors is actually becoming more aged rather than the younger people are coming into it, and it's harder to understand it. And, you know, when I came into it, I could buy a cap box for a dollar. You know, today they're 100 to 150. So, you know, the dollar, I had a dollar back then, but can a 13-year-old kid buy something for $200? It's hard.
That's a lot of lawns.
Yeah, I was about to say.
That's a lot of lawns,
What was your best, we're just getting ready to wrap this up pretty quickly, but what was your best find? What was your or most exciting find?
Ever.
Well, I agree with your opening statement. You know, let me just back up a second here. You said the war was brother versus brother. I wrote that down here. Mary Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's wife, her brothers fought for the South. States divided. Maryland was divided. Virginia was divided. And you're exactly right. Many people who collect Civil War collect it for the history. So I can give you a great history story, or I can give you a great dollar story.
Can we have both?
I'll give you
a little bit of both, yeah.
My best items, I had some killer uniforms. I had some great uniforms. I had the president of Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. I had his complete set of uniforms.
Wow.
That I was the third private collector to own them. The government actually owns them right now. There was an article in North-South Trader Civil War on those uniforms 2 issues ago.
Interesting.
But, yeah, the government bought them to put them away. But lo and behold, you know, I didn't get them this way, but they were sold off of the family's front yard in a lawn sale.
You've got to be kidding.
Oh, wow.
So it can happen. But I sold the uniforms, sets sold in excess of $28,000, I think, is what I...
Okay, how long ago was that, that it was sold at the yard sale?
We're talking probably 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
30 Jeez. Years ago. My best story, when I was like 15, I had my dad take me to an auction where some guns were being sold in the Adirondacks. The lady stood up with these two blankets, held them up. She said, how much for the blankets? Buy them per piece. I bid like $3. My dad saying, what are you, nuts? $3? You know? I won for $8. The lady said, which blanket do you want? I said, I'll take the brown one with the U.S. in the middle. I got it home. I networked with a collecting friend of mine. I brought it to him. His eyes go wide. He grabs it, takes it out of my hand, and he says, it's Civil War. What'd you pay for it? I said, I don't know. What's it worth? And so he holds up at the time like five fingers. And I said, I paid $8. It's worth $5. I lost $3. He said, no, it's worth like $500. But at the time I sold that, I sold 80% of my collection a few years ago. When I sold that at auction, it sold for
$8,000. Oh,
wow. Not a bad buy for $8. So
yeah,
you
made
a thousand percent.
My other good story is there was an auction advertised a section of a flag. They advertised it as a section of an infantry flag. I went and looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
I drove up. It was a smaller section, but it actually said in the bottom, if you looked at it closely, in bold lettering, some of the lettering had dropped out with age, but it said Merrill's Horse. Well, Horse is a cavalry regiment. Cavalry mm-hmm. flags are smaller than mm-hmm. infantry flags.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being a small fragment of an infantry flag, it actually ended up being 75% of a cavalry standard. Merrill's Horse, Merrill was one of Lincoln's pallbearers for the Loyal Legion.
Oh, jeez.
all of his uniforms, diaries, and flags actually were already in a museum. This was a piece that never made it to the museum.
Mm.
I traced it through various family relatives. It was donated to a historical society. I don't see it so much today, but historical societies do deaccession stuff off, and this was being deaccessioned.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I had to beat a little old lady at the auction for a grand sum of $200 to buy that flag. But, you know, it was Colonel Merrill, the 1st Missouri Cav. It was his unit's hand-embroidered bald eagle flying across a blue banner with gold fringe, you know, saying Merrill's Horse. And that actually went to the government also for a sum of right around $20,000.
Tidy profit again.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very rare. Now, I can tell you those stories, but I have 35 years to tell those stories.
That's right. Yeah, that's the part people don't...
It happened in a few.
The people don't understand that part of it. It takes a long time to get there.
You got to get the knowledge, and it doesn't happen all the time. I used to tell people if I could get a couple good finds a year, I was doing good.
Mm.
But the more my knowledge increased, the number of successful stories I could tell increased also.
Well, John, you've been absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
I think
so fascinating.
Yes. I almost want to do this again, this segment too.
Yeah, right.
You're gonna have to think up new questions.
Now, John, why don't you plug your website?
Well, I have a small website. It's Cottle Hill. I live on the coast here, right near the ocean, and we're actually on the crest of a small hill. So it's www.cottlehill.com, and it's just an information site. I have a few things for sale on it. You can see some of my old collections posted on there, and then you can link on it. I'm getting into antique duck decoys now. I think you know that, Martin.
I do, yes.
So there's some photos of my turn of century. century duck decoys on there, and also a link to the 25th Mass history site that I started.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go on and look at various items that I own that are associated with that regiment. Identified swords, identified diaries, photographs. I have a section of their flag, mm-hmm. silver medals, some uniform pieces, some rifle pieces, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So CottleHill.com.
Very good.
And
thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to say from the very beginning that I wanted to say thank you to both you, John, and Martin, because you're two people who, you know, you're not afraid to, you're not, let alone not being afraid, you're really willing to pass down information. And that's, I mean, it's so important. And a lot of people in this business really are, you know, they're stingy with their information, with their expertise. But you guys are going to keep the industry alive, basically, because, you know, these artifacts don't have worth if you don't know their history.
That's right.
Right, and that's a big factor. You know, we've seen, I have very close friends who unfortunately have passed away in the past few years, and they had immense collections, and they knew the history of all their items, but they unfortunately didn't put it down before they passed away, and
right.
the collections get disseminated, and the history gets lost.
Yeah, it's a shame.
So that is a shame, and it's one thing to say something over the phone and pass information on like this. It's another thing to hold a real item in your hand and say, is it right, is it wrong, and what does
right.
it mean?
Yeah.
And
that's where the networking and the contacting the experts and listening to Marty at the auction hall when he tells you he's researched something, like that's what the important part is.
You know, something you mentioned earlier is you knew right away when you saw something in your hand, and I get that all the time. Someone will say, well, why do you think it's this? Why do you think it's that? And really, a lot of times I can't tell them. It's just like the feeling I have instantly when I see it. It's like when you see a really fine painting, you know it's a real fine painting. If you've been doing it long enough, you know. So
well, we have a trained eye somewhat in the genres that we're looking at.
Right, right. Well, John, you've been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.
I enjoyed it also, Marty. Thank you very much. And Phyllis, enjoyed talking to you too.
Thanks.
Great. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Take care,
okay.
John.
Take care, Marty.
Bye.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.
So that was John Ackerblum. That was great.
Oh,
so,
what a nice guy.
Yes. Yeah. And we ran a little longer than we normally do. In closing, I just wanted to say I was looking up what I thought would be kind of fascinating and some of the inventions that happened during the Civil
yes,
War.
Yes, wartime. Necessity is the mother of invention.
That's right. That's right. Oh, there were so many different things invented during the Civil War. If you think about it, it was only like a four-year period. Mm-hmm. Anesthesia was invented, which is very needed.
That's pretty important, yeah.
Hand grenades. You'd never think hand grenades were. The thing I thought was very interesting, I didn't even know about until I looked this up, was aerial reconnaissance. They had hot air. They had helium balloons.
Really?
And they would look down at the enemies, and they even took a coal barge and made an aircraft carrier out of it.
Isn't a little obvious? You're like, hey, what's that big thing in the sky? I think I see guys with binoculars.
Yeah, but who's going to be looking up? You know, no one ever thought to look up, did they? I don't know. Especially, you wouldn't hear, if it was a hot air balloon, of course, you'd hear it. But a helium balloon, not necessarily, you wouldn't be looking up in the sky.
I guess it was a gloomy day. You know, the sun doesn't get
coming. Yeah. The thing I think was pretty interesting in that whole thing is submarines, you know, the use of submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And the first successful torpedo launch was from a submarine that housed 8 soldiers that hand-cranked the propeller.
Wow.
And if you think about how dark it must have been inside, and they had to have, like, oil lamps or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds dismal.
Doesn't sound too fun. Mm-hmm. But how could they possibly launch a torpedo from a hand-cranked submarine?
How fast do you think it went?
There's many, many other things that were invented during the Civil War. But
smoke screen, that's cool.
Smoke screen, working machine gun, of course. Hospital ships. U.S. Secret Service started then also. And repeating rifles, anti-aircraft fire. Now, anti-aircraft fire could only be to the balloons.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know what else it would be.
But
anyway, it's been a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy the show. Again, please do search us out on iTunes. And if you're finding us on iTunes, our website is www.antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Our email address is
auctionpodcast@me.com.
thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gall.
Signing
off.